Well, good evening, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing? I want to thank Frank for asking me down here, and I see things haven't changed. Nobody sits in the front row. They didn't sit there when I first came in. My sponsor made me sit up there. He called it an incurable row. And he'd say, you sit up there, because you might miss something if you're sitting anywhere else. But I sure remember that tendency. I like to sit near the door. And then just in case something happened, I could be out of there. And I always wanted to be able to get out of there. That was sort of how I operated in the drinking years. I always had that feeling, old Hugh McGee used to call it impending doom. You know, that there was something bad about to happen, and if you're near the door, you can get out quick. When I look back at my drinking, I think of a lot of fear. My primary memory of alcoholism is being afraid. I don't know exactly what it was. I was afraid people would find out who I really was. I was afraid somebody would ask me to do something that I didn't know how to do, and then I'd look bad. I was afraid that I just wouldn't be able to remember anything. Couldn't figure things out. And what fixed all that was alcohol. That I look back on it now, and I think that a lot of people, when they're trying to grow up, are kind of nervous. You're a teenager. You're wandering around wondering what's going on. You haven't got the foggiest idea, but it's very important that you pretend to be cool and know everything that's going on. And when you don't know what's going on and you're trying to be cool, you can't ask anybody what's going on, because then they'll say, hey, that guy doesn't know what's going on because he's over here asking what's going on. So you never ask. You just sort of try to figure it out, you know, and I don't know what I was trying to figure out, whatever teenagers are trying to figure out, mostly women, where to get money, how to keep your driver's license, how to get on a football team so you could be somebody. I think deep down inside of us there's this desire to be somebody. And after I got in AA, I think I figured out what that was. That it was really had to do with a relationship with a higher power. That was what all that was about, but I thought it was something else, and that I could fix that desire to be somebody by getting money or getting a good-looking woman or getting to be the president of some club or somewhere you could be somebody that way. But no matter what I accomplished, and I did pretty good. I got onto some athletic teams and got pretty good grades until I started drinking. I come from New Haven, Connecticut, and I managed to get into Yale University. And so if you looked at how this guy's doing, you would say, well, he's going along all right. But inside, it just wasn't there. I felt like I was a phony, you know what I mean, that somebody was going to come along and go, what are you doing in here? And just take me out of circulation. I just had that tremendous insecurity and feeling that I didn't belong like the rest of the people did. Now, as I think about things, that is normally taken care of through a process that a lot of us in here have never been subjected to, and it's called growing up. That's what we go through, what human beings go through to get rid of those kind of feelings. They just deal with them, and eventually they become comfortable with themselves, and it's sort of a painful process. And in general, I think we refer to those people as grown-ups. And when my father still asks me what I want to be when I grow up, and I give him an answer now, a grown-up, I'm settling with that would be fine with me if I went around and people said, that's a grown-up over there. But there aren't too many of us in AA that they say that about. They say it's a miracle he's sober and things like that. But they don't really point into the fellowship and say, there it is, all grown-ups. But we'll get there. We keep hanging in here and get back into the world and start doing things like that. But anyway, I just established that for you so you sort of know what my insides were like. And on the outside, it may have looked like things were all right. Alcohol came along. I was 19 before I had my first drink, and within 20 minutes of starting to drink, I knew I had found the secret to life. That's what alcohol meant to me. The other guys who started drinking with me, that's not what it meant to them. It was a way to have a good time. It was this and that. I kid around. I talk about there is a particular guy who did start drinking with me then. He lives down in Texas, and I've spoken down in Dallas where he lives, and he's very interested in AA because it saved my life, so he comes to meetings. He's not an alcoholic, but he enjoys AA, and sometimes we'll get talking afterwards. And I remember talking to him one time. I said, Roy, I said, you're same age I am now. You've been around this planet for a long time, and you still drink. And you and I did some pretty good drinking back in school. I said, if you were to sit down with a piece of paper and describe your drinking, you know, what drinking means to you, what would you write down? So he scratched his head, and he said, well, the first thing I'd write down is that alcohol makes food taste better. And I remember looking at him going, alcohol makes food taste better. I mean, you know, this is the top of his list for drinking, is that it makes food taste better. He'd been drinking all these years. And I thought to myself, going down or coming up? You know what I mean? I mean, what? Alcohol makes food taste better. That's all he had to say about alcohol. And then he went on to say, well, also, after I get off work, if I've had a real rough day and I come home, so I'll get a beer or a drink, and I'll sit there and sort of drink that down. And it sort of marks the end of the work day, and I can go up and take a shower and come back down and be with my family. And it's just a way of unwinding a little and putting the work day behind me and then getting down to settling down to being with the family. I didn't relate to that at all. I would have a drink and disappear from the family. So it, we didn't have anything in common on those two. And then he said, and then once in a while, my friends will come over and we'll have a party. It'll be a Saturday night. We'll get 15, 20 people over there, and we'll serve drinks, and people just get happy, and they're chatting with one another, and it breaks down the social nervousness, and people just have a good time, and then we all go home. And that was his entire description of drinking for him, a non-alcoholic. He never mentioned once that drinking was the secret of life for him. He never mentioned once that alcohol held all the answers to life's problems, which is what I would have written down. And so when you look at this, you have two guys of the same age, similar backgrounds, who started drinking at the same time. One of them's an alcoholic and one of them's not an alcoholic. And you know what you notice there? You see, he had some bad things happen when we were drinking. He got arrested a couple times, got in a fight with some cops, and so on down. So alcohol did some bad things to him. But the real difference when you start looking at this is what alcohol did for us. And what it did for me was entirely different than what it did for him. And I now, as I think back on it, that's what makes me an alcoholic, is alcohol does things for me that it doesn't do for the non-alcoholics. It literally was like a higher power, in that I could have absolute faith in alcohol to contain not only the answers to my problems, but the power to carry that out. You know what I mean? Almost like our program. So if I was sitting there, I don't know about you all, but when I would, once I started drinking, if I was standing around the house and a problem came up, and I was standing there, I'm home alone, all of a sudden a problem comes up, and I go, God, I've got to really figure this out. Do you ever have those things? Boy, this is a situation, I got to stop here, and I got to really figure this out. What was the first thing you do when you really had to figure something out? Have a drink. You know what I mean? I remember just going, that's right, I've got to figure something out. I'm going to go get a drink. And then I'd pour the drink down, and then I would start figuring things out. And after two or three drinks, I'd have it all figured out. It was just real easy to figure things out with three drinks in me, but if there wasn't any drinks in me, I couldn't figure anything out. And does that sound familiar to the promises in our big book where it talks about we will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us? I would just have three drinks and I would intuitively know how to handle something. I didn't, couldn't have the slightest idea. I remember going, geez, you know, here I am at a dance. How do you learn how to dance? Three drinks. That's how you learn how to dance. Hey, do you know how to dance? Yes, I intuitively know how to dance. I know how to go up and ask a woman out. I know how to do all of these things through drinking. And so suddenly this social elixir became my best friend. It was something that I had faith in. It was something that, without realizing it, I had turned my life over to the care of vodka and totally relied on it. I mean, it didn't matter. I could look at the... I was like the knight in shining armor with a secret weapon, and my secret weapon was vodka. And I would just look at the future with all its challenges. I ended up getting in the Marine Corps, and I became a fighter pilot. We're going overseas and this and that, and I'm just going, hey, as long as they got vodka over there, all will be fine. You know what I mean? And I checked ahead. They had plenty of vodka over in Japan where we were going. I said, well, then going over there will be no problem because vodka will be there. And so it was just, you know, I just looked to the future, and as long as alcohol was there, I got very comfortable about everything because this was my secret higher power to get through whatever situation might come along. I can remember after I came into AA, just to show you the power of this power, or even one other example, in the later stages when I really got started getting shaky and everything was really coming unglued, and I hadn't become a daily drinker yet, and I think, you know, that comes along eventually if you keep hanging in there. You just need to drink during the day. You can't make it until 5 o'clock anymore. But you know what would help me sometimes when I needed to drink real bad? Just to show you that it wasn't just the chemical alcohol. If I was in a real tight situation, I had some important meeting coming up or whatever that's going on in the Marine Corps, and I'm real nervous, I got to give a briefing, oh boy, this is going to be rough. If I could get to a window and look out the window and see my car in the parking lot and see that it was still there, knowing that the vodka was in the glove compartment, I felt better. You know what I mean? So instead of sneaking a drink, I would sneak a look. You know what I mean? I'd just go over there. Hey, that car's right there. And technically, I could have that vodka in me in 32 seconds. And knowing that it was that close calmed me down. I didn't even have to drink it. And you know what I mean? It's like, okay, I could get it that fast, so all is well. And the funny thing is, after I got into AA... You know, we're not going to drink anymore. All right, that's it. I'm totally getting rid of my dependence on alcohol. But for a number of months, probably close to a year, never told my sponsor, but in my wallet, in a secret compartment, was a $50 bill, all folded up. And that $50 bill was just in case I really was that one guy that God doesn't like. You know what I mean? And that this program wasn't going to work for me. You have to cover your ass. You know what I'm talking about? You got to have this emergency bailout. And all you needed was the $50 bill and the address of the nearest package store. And you had that sort of in there. And then you could sort of rely on the program. You know what I mean? Well, it's very difficult to turn your life over when part of it is a $50 bill in your wallet that you have as an emergency parachute just in case the program doesn't work. But that's how strong the attachment to alcohol was. It was literally what I relied on and had complete faith in. Now, once that somebody who was, 16, 18, 19, 13, whenever we started, once we make this relationship with alcohol as our means of getting through life, we literally stop growing up because we never go through the normal pains of relationships breaking up, of not making the team, of not getting the promotion, of not getting on the dean's list, or whatever the various things happen, as that happens to human beings, then you get this rejection and you deal with it and you become a stronger person for having gone through these setbacks and bouncing up off the floor and charging back in to try again, even though you fail. And we become stronger and stronger as we move along through life. But once I got a hold of alcohol, I never did that. Relationship breaks up, you just get drunk for a week. You know what I mean? You just sit around the house and cry buckets of tears and just pour down bottle after bottle of booze and just totally use something else to get through situations. And so it's a tremendous shock for a lot of us to come into Alcoholics Anonymous at whatever age we are, 25, 35, 45, and suddenly be stripped naked of our total game plan for living. In other words, my whole plan, you know, if somebody were to ask me my philosophy of life, everybody's supposed to be developing some kind of a philosophy of life. You know, what is your words of wisdom? What is your outlook on this and that? Hell, mine was drink. That was the entire, I could write a whole philosophical book and it would just be one word. Just drink. Everything will be fine. Just, you know, whatever the situation is, just drink. And come in here and you say, don't drink. I couldn't believe you were saying that to me, because when you said don't drink, you're taking away my whole repertoire. That's it. That's how I existed as a human being, and you're saying no longer can you have the drinking. And that's why just not drinking doesn't work. That's why we have to have a program. We got to have a game plan for living, which is what I think we have here in Alcoholics Anonymous, is literally a plan for us that just didn't have it. And, of course, what stands in the way, and I don't know about you all, but when I came in, I heard this, but my ego didn't want to admit that. What do you mean I don't know how to live? Or what do you mean I don't have a plan for living? And we have that great line in Chapter 5, old ideas availed us nothing. And, of course, the old ideas are my ideas that I put together. And we all come in here with this whole collection of ideas. And a tremendous percentage of them are wrong. I mean, just look at how the thousands of things that I had wrong, starting with, am I an alcoholic or not? I mean, just start with that one. Here I've been drinking. I only drank for about 15 years, but I ended up in a nut ward, locked up for 6 months with the convulsions and the DTs and malnutrition and straitjackets and all of those things. So I had ample evidence that I might be an alcoholic, in addition to all the trouble I got in. Somewhere I lost my train of thought. Old ideas. But I was not an alcoholic. I mean, I just was not. You'd ask me when I went to my first meeting. In the nut ward, a corpsman came in to the Bethesda Naval Hospital. I got to AA in 1964 when a corpsman came into the nut ward and said, all drunks fall in. That was how I got to AA. I was a drunk. And so three of us in our bathrobes stood at the door, and he marched us down, got in the elevator, and we went downstairs where two or three guys from the Bethesda, Maryland AA group had talked their way back into the hospital. There was no AA. AA had been there, I guess, in 63, and after 6 months, the psychiatrist determined that it was doing more damage than good, so they got rid of AA. That shows you the dark ages of the military, or just society in general, as far as alcoholism was concerned. But they had come back and persuaded the psychiatrist that AA really was a very wonderful thing for their alcoholics, and I was on the ward when that happened. So these three guys from Bethesda are talking and giving this big meeting, and I went up after. I thought it was great. I heard all this stuff. I'm listening. And I went up and said to them, you know, you guys really got a hell of a deal going here. I can see how much it benefited you, and I'll tell you, if I run into a guy with a drinking problem, I'm going to send him around to see you. And here I am, locked up in there, and I'm carrying on like I don't relate to being part of the problem. I'm going to find other guys with drinking problems. I'm going to be a recruiter for AA, but I'm not going to join myself. And that's when I got the first taste of AA's hard love, where this little redheaded guy just looked at me and said, well, before I go home, let me just ask you one question. Which one of us is going to put his overcoat on and go out and get in his car and drive on home to his family? And which one of us is going to put his little blue bathrobe back on and go over in that elevator and go upstairs and get locked up like an animal? Now, which one are you? And I remember just going, this guy is rude. You know what I mean? I just met him 3 minutes ago. I'm being real nice, and he comes off with this wise guy stuff. And, of course, it hurt real deep. It hurt down there where it really hurts. You know what I mean? Like, boy, they got my number. I mean, these guys are seeing right through me. And I noticed that a lot in AA. Everybody seemed to see right through me. And I didn't realize that was true, that all of you that were here before I got here could see right through me as a newcomer. And those of you that are new here now, you'll probably notice that everybody sort of sees right through all your bullshit, right into the real reality of life. And you wonder if they have psychic powers, and that's not it. You just have to understand something, that all the people in this room invented the game that you're playing. And that's why they see right through you, because they were involved in the very same activities themselves, telling the same lies, making up the same excuses, the denial, and all of that. But I didn't realize that, and I felt very nervous in the first few weeks in AA that everybody could see right through me. They already knew what I was going to say. And my sponsor in particular, he would be driving home from a meeting, and he said, what do you mean you can't go tomorrow night? And I'd say, I didn't say a word. Well, you're getting ready to say that, aren't you? I'm going, how the hell did he know? You know what I mean? And he could tell from my attitude at the meeting that whatever I commented, that I was getting some stinking thinking and was getting ready to make up some excuse so that I could just get out of here. And that made me real nervous that everybody sort of had my number. And now that I look back on it, that's what saved my life and will save your life, is the fact that people do have your number and they see you getting ready to break and they stop it and they interrupt all of this fleeing from the situations when it gets kind of tough. So in any event, that's how I got to AA. I did this. I was an inpatient in the nut ward, and when I got to be an outpatient, I went back to drinking for about 3 days. Damn near got caught bringing vodka onto the nut ward, but I didn't. And I called AA myself. I was down at Quantico, Virginia, and a big guy came over to my house who is still my sponsor and took me to Manassas, Virginia on Pearl Harbor Day in 64, and that's when I had my last drink. Was about 4 hours before that meeting. I had my last drink, and we got over to the meeting. It was a damn group anniversary. It was kind of a celebration like tonight. And they had turkey and ham and all the country cooking. And those of you who have been old-timers might remember Speedy Baker and his band, the Hillbilly Band. They're having a square dance afterwards, and everybody was happy, and they got all this food going around. And the meeting lasted, from 7 when the food started until midnight. And that was my first meeting. And this guy is talking about going to a meeting every night for 10 years or something like that. And I'm just going, jeez. I had no way of knowing all meetings weren't 6 hours long. And I'm just going, damn, these people are crazy. They're over here from 7 o'clock till midnight every night and dancing and eating. And I didn't want to eat. Food was making me ill, just the thought of food, and I kept running outside. And it was a real deserted area of Manassas. That building's gone now. It was the Oddfellows Hall, and it was raining and almost sleeting, and I would go out in the door to make a break for it. When I'd been there about 4 hours, now I had 8 hours sobriety. And about 8 hours, that stuff is wearing off bad, and I needed a fix. His hands are starting to shake, and I'm sweating and hurting. And I kept going out the door to look to make a break. And I can still remember a lady, and she was the wife of an alcoholic. She's still around this area. And she came out and just put her hand on my shoulder and said, "Are you all right?" And I don't know why, just now I choke up thinking about it. I turned around and said, "No." The first time I ever said that in my life. I said, "No, I'm not all right." I always said I'm all right, because if you say you're not all right, they're going to get in your business, and who knows what'll happen. But for some unknown reason, she was so kind, and there was something about the way she put her hand on my shoulder that I turned around and I said, "No." And she just gave me a big hug and said, "Everything's going to be fine." And I believed it. And I think of that possibly as the thing that kept me here. You know what I mean? That one tiny act of kindness at that crucial moment. Here's a guy been in AA for 4 hours, and something incredibly significant happened. And here I am, and it's been 25 years. I'm still going to meetings, still around here. A lot of things have happened, ups and downs. Get thrown out of Marine Corps, you know, and marriages break up, and bankruptcy, I can go through all these things that have happened in sobriety. I started to talk one night that way. I went out of town, and I just got up there and said, "You know, alcoholism is really amazing what happens to alcoholics. Take me. I got thrown out of Marine Corps and went to bankruptcy, had 15 jobs in 8 years, 4 marriages, and all that happened after I got an AA. And the people out there are going, 'Cause I don't know if I want to stick around." So I don't do that anymore, because I can see where that might, it's not a very good commercial. But my point is that sobriety doesn't cause life to straighten out. It gives us the resources to be able to be reasonably comfortable as life does this stuff, where it's your turn in the barrel this year, and you just make it, and you get the resources, and then you have the ability when things are really going your way. And sometimes I think it's more dangerous for us alcoholics when things are really going our way than it is when they're not. Because you get so damn high, you suddenly feel like, "I don't need this," and I think remember that old program, The Millionaire, when Mr. Anthony would come, it's a long time ago, television show, but somehow the name would appear and he would arrive at the door and say, "I'm Mr. Mr. Brown? Yes, I'm Mr. Anthony, and my sponsor, J. Lord, give you this cashier's check for $1 million. And it sometimes occurs to me, if that happened to everybody in AA, it might wipe the entire fellowship out. You know, just $1 million? Well, I won't be at the Valentine's dance. I'm going to New York City. I mean, you know. My point, I think, is that the program gives us an anchor, a rudder, a stability factor that enables us to handle both the highs and the lows, and gets these oscillations to level out a little bit. And that's what it's done for me. It was real hard in the beginning. I still had that emotional roller coaster of being, everything's perfect, and then the next day it's crashing down, it's awful. And I was trying to figure it out. I don't know if anybody's new here. You go around, you try to figure things out. And, you know, if I could just figure it out, I could stop it from whipsawing me like this. And, you know, we never do get it figured out. That's sort of another program other than AA. That might occur in some kind of an analysis or some other thing. But an AA really isn't a question of figuring it out. We have a different way, because we have a spiritual program. And spiritual programs don't work like intellectual programs. They don't work that way. It works entirely different. Just think about the fact that you're an alcoholic. And you remember how you wanted to figure out why you're an alcoholic? I used to obsess about that. Wonder why. Probably my mother dropped me, or it probably was when my father rejected and didn't come up. It was probably because I'm half Irish. You know, the Irish, they got in their blood. No, it must have been Catholic. Those nuns. That's why I'm an alcoholic. It was those nuns. And I used to just go ape trying to figure out why I was an alcoholic. And the reason was, and I realize now, if I could figure that out, I could go back to drinking. That was why I was on that intellectual pursuit of why am I an alcoholic. And you go around now and you talk to all the people sober in AA, and they'll give you smart aleck answers like, "I'm an alcoholic because I drank a lot," you know, something like that. But we suddenly lost interest in why we're an alcoholic. It just Isn't it? I'm not interested in figuring that out anymore. So the problem of alcoholism never got solved in the spiritual program. What happened was it got removed. It just went away and didn't bother me anymore. You know how you obsess about drinking? Those of you that are new, I'm going to tell you what a miracle is, just so you're on the lookout for it, because sometimes we have so many miracles in AA, you mistake them for something else. And this is a miracle that will occur to you, and I want you to alert you about it ahead of time so that when it happens, you'll go, you know, that was a damn miracle. This is what the miracle looks like. You've been sober about 2 months, and it's been a struggle. But you're following the orders, you're going to the meetings, and you're doing all this stuff. And you're sitting around your house one Saturday afternoon, and you're just sort of thinking, because you're secretly smarter than most of the people, and so you're still thinking. And all of a sudden, it's like a boom, this thing goes off in your head, and you go, jeez, I can't believe it. I forgot to worry about drinking last week. It's almost like an innocent little thought that just came in. You went, I forgot to worry about drinking last week. And then you may pass on and go on to some other things. Well, when that happens to you, stop. Write it down. Mark the calendar. Because what happened there was a miracle. An alcoholic forgot to worry about drinking last week? I mean, just think about it. You forgot to worry about drinking, the thing that's been obsessing you, the whole centerpiece of your whole life, and you just forgot about it? That's the spiritual program beginning to work. It is starting to remove the problem. It just isn't there harassing you. It just gets lifted out. And it gets lifted out, as our steps talk about, because we're trying to work this program. And we have a sentence that reads, our sobriety, or the solution to our alcoholism, isn't figuring it out, but rather we have a daily reprieve contingent on our spiritual condition. So we work this program that doesn't make any sense. It doesn't seem to relate to our situation. I say this all the time. When I was new, I'm looking at the steps and I'm going, okay, I'm going to be doing this, but none of this is focusing in on my big problem, which is a $2,000 loan. That was my big problem in the beginning, and for a number of years. I had this in the back of my head. If I just had a $2,000 loan, everything would be fine. I mean, I had a million problems that would be solved with that, but I didn't. There was nothing about that. It was talking about getting rid of resentment, going to meetings all the time, talking about a higher power. I didn't believe in a higher power, trying inventories, all these various things. So I'm going along with it. I know it's not going to work. And then I noticed I forgot to worry about drinking last week. And you know, that is amazing. And that is what freedom is all about. We're getting freedom from our own character defects. Our own character defects are the things, the drives that are in us that are jerking us all around. And when I looked at that, you know, there's many a night, even in the drinking days, when I couldn't escape from myself any longer, and I'd be sitting on a bed and I'd be thinking about suicide. You know, you just can't go on living like this. You're just a terrible father, you're a terrible Marine, you're a washed up pilot, you're nobody. And you ought to just blow your brains out if you had any guts. You know how you get down feeling that bad? Well, why was I feeling that bad? What was it that was making me feel that bad? You ever think about that? The reason I was feeling that bad is there was something inside of me that didn't want me to be the way I was. I didn't know what that was, but there was a part of me that wanted to be a good father. There was a part of me that wanted to be a responsible person. There was a part of me that I've come to realize is my essence or my soul or the good in me that's just there. It's just a fundamental good part of us. And that was trying to be heard from. That wonderful quality that is our linkage to a higher power was trying to be an influence in my life. And my whole life was in conflict with that, which was the good part of me. And to show you the insanity, I thought about that and I said, you know, there's a terrible conflict going on here. I'm behaving just the opposite of the way part of me wants me to be. How can I fix this solution and get peace of mind? You know what my solution was? I'll try and kill that good part of me and shut it up, because there's no way I can change the way I live, and so I'll just try and become real bad. You know what I mean? And you just think about that. You're trying to kill the best part of you because you know you're powerless over changing the way you live. And no wonder we think about jumping out the window. It's just the future looks awful based on this dynamics that's going on inside of us. And we come into AA, and what do they tell us? They tell us that what we want to do is get in touch with that part, that's the part we want to cultivate and grow and bring out. Because when we bring that part of us out, we start liking ourselves, and we find out that's the real me. That's what I was born. I was born that person, that wonderful, as Chuck Chamberlain calls it, that child of God. And the more we bring that out, the more we love ourselves. And we just go, man, I really am somebody. And so I look at this, there's so many paradoxes in sobriety, and that is certainly one of them that I've been doing a lot of thinking about lately. I read somewhere a very interesting sentence. And the guy was saying, take a piece of paper and write down everything that you are as a little exercise. So you get a piece of paper and you write down, well, I am a woman, I am white, I am Protestant, I am a Republican, I am educated at such and such, I am a very good stockbroker, I am studying to be a psychiatrist, I am a good tennis player, I am a mother, I am, and you just list everything you can think of that defines you. And then at the end of the exercise, the guy said, now take a look at that list, because that's what separates you from God. Now, wasn't that an interesting way to look at things? All of that is saying, this is who I am, and it's leaving out who I really am, which is, I am nothing more than an extension of a higher power. And what's standing in between me and being that are all our character defects, which are born within us. They're instincts, and we learn in our step four that these are just drives that are born in human beings, and they're there to make sure we stay alive and reproduce and go out and aggressively move ahead. So they're there like the steam or the fire in a locomotive. I look upon that. That's what all those drives are in me. It's like the fire that's under the kettle in a steam locomotive. Without that fire, that thing isn't going anywhere. But what happens if the fire takes over and the fire gets as big as it wants and is out of control? It'll blow that boiler right off of the train, and it'll explode the whole train, and it just comes totally unglued. And so the secret to this whole thing is control over the fire. Control. And I don't know about you all, but when I'm in my early years in AA, my character defects were in charge. You know what I mean? I'd say, hey, here's what I decided up here. I'd say, you know, I'm going to go over to that new meeting over there. They're discussing steps and this and that. And then fear would say, you don't know anybody over there. Don't go. And then I wouldn't go, because fear said, don't go there. Or I'd say, well, you know, I'm going to really behave myself. I'm not going to stop having all these affairs or whatever it is. And then lust would say, wrong. You can do that next year. But for now, you're going to be doing it this way. And that's, all right, well, I'm going to be a better guy. I'm going to be more harmonious in the world. And then anger would say, wrong, bam, and you hit somebody. And you're wondering why we're not in harmony with the world around us. It's because these drives, these character defects, are out totally in control of my life. And so I was trying to figure that out. I was trying to figure out, well, how can I get control of this? How can I stay in control? Come in the program. Does it say anything about getting in control? Teach us how to get in control. What does it say? It says, surrender. Let go. Let go. And the funny thing is, we're not supposed to be able to harness those on our own resources. I think they were put there as a natural drive to keep us going, but they also inevitably lead us to a higher power. The first higher power that they led me to was vodka. And I found that with vodka, I was able to put a lot of that stuff in control. And so I was on the right track. I was on the right track that human beings cannot become good people on their own. See, that was why I was on such a guilt trip. I would say, I'm a bad person. I'm fundamentally bad, and it's my fault. I have to try harder to be a good person. Come in here, and they go, you can try all you want, but you aren't going to be able to do that. Because this program has nothing to do about what I can do. What I have to do is surrender. So I was trying to do the impossible. I was trying, a good person by definition is a spiritual person. I was trying to become a spiritual person without a higher power. See, I was going to be my own higher power. Because I didn't want a God involved in this thing, because you know what God will do if you get him in your life. He doesn't want you to have any good times. You know what I mean? That was the way I previously thought about it. Don't want to get God involved too soon. Let's get him in. Here was my plan for living. You raise hell, do all the things you want till you're about 83. And then you can't do them anymore anyway. So then you straighten out at the last minute, and you get to go to heaven with all those assholes that straightened out when they were 20. You know what I mean? And I felt secretly superior to those jerks. You didn't have to straighten out this soon. You're going home to your house every night and all that boring stuff, and I'm out where life is. And those are some of the old ideas, you know, that I'm sure there's other people in this room had that similar insane thought pattern that will straighten out later. And I had no idea how exciting life was on the main highway. I mean, I always was over here on the fringes. The massage parlors were over here. They weren't on the main road. And I had no idea what was going on here that was so attractive. Any more than you could figure out, why do AA people go to these damn meetings? Did you ever wonder about AA before you got here? You know, have your friends say, hey, I'm so happy, I'm having a little, what do you do? Well, we go down in a smoky church basement and talk about resentment for an hour. Then we all go home happy. You go, what? What? It just doesn't look like it should work, does it? I mean, it doesn't look like this program should work, that we sit around talking about these things. But here was the deal, see? The deal was I was trying to exist without a higher power. That was the craziness. That was the missing ingredient. I was trying to become a spiritual person, or a good person, whatever you want to call it. I was trying to have a philosophy. I was trying to have a code of ethics that I could live by on my own. And that is what's impossible to do. That's why you keep failing. And then you think you're a bad person. And you say, look, God, I failed again. I can't live up to these standards. I have to lower my standards. That was another thing. Has anybody done that? I'll just lower the damn standards. You know what I mean? And I got them all the way down to the gutter and still couldn't live up to them. And I just kept going lower. Now, talk about willpower. Few people think about it. You don't sink to the gutter. You have to claw your way to the gutter. I mean, it's not an easy journey. You have to work hard to get that bad. Is all parts of us that don't want us to be there. Shut up, I'm going to keep going down. Nobody's going to save me. Is this the incredible ego? And the point was, I may be going to the gutter, but at least I'm in charge. See what I'm saying? It's my journey, my life. I did it my way. Boy, if I was drinking, that would be my theme song. Did it my way. I didn't chicken out and ask for help. I didn't chicken out and get a sponsor. I didn't chicken out and do those steps. Some of us know how to hang in there. You ever hear that kind of talk? I'm going to just hang in there. Hang in there. Pretty soon you're just going to hang. So it was strange thinking to come to the conclusion that somehow I could become the type of person that I wanted to be on my own. And when in the final analysis, that was the fatal flaw in my whole thinking, that I was trying to get through life without a higher power. Is that simple? That's how important a higher power is, because that's the secret to all the rest of this. That's what lifts us up out of the gutter, out of our own self-centeredness, up where the view is great. See, you just can't get up there on your own. You can just, as Clancy likes to say, no matter how well you work this program, you cannot go beyond human being. And human beings can be incredibly diverse, just one person. One day I feel like I'm approaching Saint Teresa, Mother Teresa, and the next day I'm doing some of the sleaziest, petty stuff you can imagine. I go, God, what are you? And I'm a human being. That's what I am. And in here, with these steps, I've been given access to the power base. Just for new people, I'll tell you why this is so important. The reason a higher power is so important is contained in our first step. That's why a higher power is so important. Because you admitted that you're powerless over alcohol. When you say you're powerless over alcohol, this is what you've really said, even though you may not have intended to have said this. You're saying that you have a situation that only a higher power can fix. That's what powerless means. It's an automatic setup for needing a higher power. I always explain it to new people with the only analogy I've ever been able to think up, and that is because I used to do flying. If that this is your real initiation into Alcoholics Anonymous. We take you out and we put you in the AA plane, and we take you up where you get the view so you can see what sobriety is all about, and you think you're getting sort of an orientation ride, and what we're going to really give you is a lesson in powerlessness. And we get you up to 50,000 feet. We say, how do you like the view? What do you think of AA now? Oh, it's wonderful. And then we tip the plane upside down real fast, and you fall out. And you have no chute, but you have the little radio headset, and we're talking with you. We're going, hey, you're getting the feeling of powerless now. And they're going, you're going, yeah, I'm getting a feeling of powerlessness. That's powerlessness. And we're going, well, good. We just want you to sort of deal with it and understand what powerlessness is. You know? And some people are real smart, Alex, and they go 50,000 feet. You know, it takes 3 minutes or so to fall from that height. And you've seen those guys, the skydivers. And so you start giving it this, you know, going around clouds and figuring, hey, they're going to pull the plane under me any second. I don't know how this works, but I'm sure I'll be back in there. And we're just going, do you understand powerlessness? Have you got a feeling of power? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Then all of a sudden, if you fall 40,000 feet or so, relative motion starts picking up. And you start looking at the parking lot outside the club here, and it's getting bigger faster than it was the previous 2 minutes. And now it's picking up and it's getting real fast, and you're seeing a big truck down there that seems to have an X on it with your name. That unless something happens, you're going to hit that truck, splat. And about 8 feet from that truck, a big hand comes down out of the heavens and grabs you and says this. Excuse me. We're conducting a survey here. Do you believe in God? That's the time, and that's what powerless means. And that's how you become spiritual. A lot of times you come in the program, everybody's talking these spiritual things, and you thought they were born spiritual, that they were saints just waiting to pursue this wonderful life of character building, and that's not true. All of us came to that spot where we were about to go splat, and someone said, do you believe in God? And, of course, my answer was, no, I don't. But under these conditions, I'm willing to reconsider. And that's what it's all about. And so the real way to get the AA program is right off of the first step. A lot of people come in here and they've been sober for 6-7 years. Program isn't working right. And they're going, I haven't taken enough inventory. I haven't done this. I haven't done that. You know what the problem was? They never took the first step 100%. Somehow they skated by that powerlessness, and they, in the back of their mind, reached the conclusion that they were semi-powerless over alcohol, that they were almost powerless over alcohol, which means you almost need a higher power. It means you almost need a sponsor. You almost need the rest of the steps. And almost needing it is like not having it at all. Because unless we totally, unconditionally open ourselves to the need for a higher power, we won't get any of it. We'll be left trying to function as a human being on our own resources. And so it's really important to do that 100% back in the beginning and to go and take that step. It's the only one we can take 100%. And as soon as you do that, you'll see the freedom of not having to be your own higher power. That is one of the greatest burdens for us egocentric people that there is to try and go through life being our own higher power. Because we get the feeling, then I'm somebody. And the paradox, these spiritual paradoxes are just amazing, because we become somebody by becoming nobody, by becoming powerless. I am nothing without a higher power. But with a higher power, I'm everything. I'm everything. I'm everything I want to be, everything I can ever be. I really believe that I already am all that I can ever become. I just have to discover it. And what we do is get rid of character defects and find there's this beautiful person deep down inside every one of us. The gift that Alcoholics Anonymous gives us is ourselves. It gives us this beautiful person that is down inside of you, and all we do is uncover, discover, and discard. We just inventory, find another damn thing that's in the way, throw it out of there, and pretty soon what's left is this beautiful person that was there all along. So oddly enough, character building is done by getting rid of things. Everything is sort of backwards in a spiritual program. And so for those of you that are new, and this is Valentine's Day and all those, you think of gifts and that stuff, that's what's going to be given to you, is through the love of this program, you're going to grow to love yourself and find out what a remarkably beautiful, wonderful, useful, giving, sharing, caring person you really are. All of those other ideas that you had about ourself are right in Chapter 5. They availed us nothing. They're wrong. You're dead wrong about yourself. You're a magnificent, sober human being. Thanks a lot.